An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting back there.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten ass system. Stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio on KPFA.
Right now, we want to take a trip to Washington, D.C., talk to a good friend of mine. He's a scholar, he's an activist. He's also a former presidential candidate for the Green Party back a few years ago. His name is Jared Ball. And Jared is somebody who, when it comes to the truth, he will go digging and digging until he finds it, even after everybody has left. And one of the places that he's gone digging, him and his co-author, Todd Burrows, is around the subject of Malcolm X. Malcolm X has made headlines over the past couple of years because of a book that just recently won a Pulitzer Prize by Manny Marable, the late Manny Marable. And there were a number of things that were said in that book that raised a lot of eyebrows. Among them was the relationship between Malcolm and his late wife, Betty Shabazz. I know the family. We've had them on our show. They were like, nah, that's not true. But people who were in Marable's camp said, nah, it is true. There were allegations that Malcolm X had a gay relationship. Of course, that was denied by the family. Again, people who supported Marable said it was true. And then there was a whole lot of other points of contention. And so Jared Ball and others got together and you wrote a book. Is it The Reinvention of Malcolm X, or give me the full title?
Well, Manny Marable's book was called A Life of Reinvention.
Right.
And so what we did with ours, correcting that, was to title our book A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X.
Now, when you correct somebody like Manny Marable, you know, here's a guy, professor at Columbia University. He's a giant among giants in academia. And so when somebody challenges him like that, you don't take that lightly. Your thoughts on just the politics around that, and what does it mean when you go against somebody who has that much, I guess gravitas is the word I'm looking for.
Well, we were careful to try to make the point that our criticism is not of Manny Marable as a human being, as an individual, or his or to be critical of his entire life's work. In fact, many of the contributors, including myself, and ours is an edited volume, co-edited by myself and Todd Burrows, to mount a sort of collective, or as Margot Arnold calls it, a response of the black radical collective consciousness to a giant of a scholar who we feel that with this book had become a voice of the state, a voice of the conservative tendency to want to liberalize, if I could put those two together, Malcolm X, to bring him more to the political center, to make him more palatable in a post-racial, post-Obama era. So we understood that what we were doing and what we wanted to do was to have it be a collective response. We didn't think this would be something that should be taken up by just one person. Malcolm X sort of belongs to most of us or all of us. So we wanted to have a collective response so that it wouldn't, you know, be reduced to something that between individual academics, individual scholars, individual human beings.
Right.
And then we are also recognizing that Manny Marable has a big name. He's represented in this case by one of the largest book publishers in the world and one of the most powerful and dominant institutions academically in the world, Columbia University. So we were arguing that the reinvention they claimed of Malcolm X is indeed a lie, and we wanted to challenge that, again, collectively.
Let me ask you this. First, if you can hold up the book so everybody can see it, because I don't have my copy here. So that is it. The second thing is, before we get into the meat and potatoes of what you all are countering, Manny Marable passed away before his book came out. And from your perspective, or the perspective of the people that that have contributed to the book that we're going to discuss. How much of his death do you think led to any sort of compromising of his work, or do you think his work was compromised at all in his passing?
Well, a number of us raised the concern that perhaps one of the issues led to his book being so flawed as we see it is his struggle for a long time with his physical condition, with an illness, with the pressure and the desire to not only finish what he and others were trying to conceive of as his magnum opus and to meet a publishing deadline, but to also meet a publishing deadline, and that the stress of this led to a reduced quality of work. But at the same time, he was publishing a lot, as my co-editor points out. He was publishing a lot in the last years of his life while, at least theoretically, working diligently on his great work, his quote-unquote definitive work on Malcolm X, which we think had a negative impact on the quality of that work. And then ultimately his death, we do think, and I think I'm close to, I mean, I think it's nearly unanimous in that most of us feel that had Manny Marable survived, it would have led to, and he would have welcomed or been willing to engage principled criticism in a way that would have made the discussions that we were attempting and are attempting to have more fruitful and to make this a more vibrant exchange. But his death not only was unfortunate just in terms of him, of the nature of him passing in a somewhat untimely way, but it also prevented us from having the kind of substantive debate about his book that I think we all need to be having, and why many of us came together to put together this book, and why even many more came together to put together a collective of responses for Third World Press, and ours is a Black Classic Press response. But the point is that many people wanted to respond, and we would have loved to have been able to have this discussion with Manny Marable himself. And unfortunately, those who defend his book and those who claim to have participated in the production of his book have thus far been unwilling to meet us and debate with us in any major or in any sound principled way. Save for maybe what happened at the Left Forum slightly between Amiri Baraka and Bill Fletcher. But other than that, there's been no real willingness among the book's defenders to stand up to our principal criticism.
And Bill Fletcher from Black Commentator, and Amiri Baraka, well-known poet and activist out of New Jersey, who is a friend of Malcolm. Let me ask you this before we get into the book. For people that are watching and listening, there are certain types of standards and certain type of path and methodology that is used when you are putting out what we call academic work. And that's a little bit different than if Davey D just goes out and writes a book. So can you explain that? Because I get the idea from what I'm understanding. If you all went down that path of, you know, making sure that it is academically sound, so that, you know, so it's not just you just went out and had an opinion. Talk about what it takes to put together a book like that and what Manny should have done so that we know, so that we can better understand the plane that you all are working on.
Well, indeed. I mean, one of the reasons why our book was somewhat, relatively slow in coming out is that we wanted to not make some of the mistakes we are being critical of Manny Marable of having made. We wanted to take our time and make sure that everything was tight. And on one level, I mean, it's no different than the standard of any community or any conversation from the so-called street to the so-called Ivy League tower, that at the end of the day, when you make claims on something or someone, you have a standard of determining the value of the claim. So whether it's just checking on who told you what, and to see what maybe may have been their motivation or their area of expertise on the subject to validate or to legitimize them as sources, or whether it's, you know, in an academic or journalistic sense doing the same thing. That is ultimately what we were concerned with, that the Marable book, given the time that he took with it, more than 15 and some say 20 years, the hundreds of thousands of dollars at his disposal from Columbia University, to having a research team, to having graduate students work with him, to being in New York City, to being a man of his renown, to be a scholar of his legitimacy and his reach, there should have been far more than the ultimately handful of interviews that he had for the book. There should have been much greater use of original sources and a much wider array of people assembled to be the interviewees and the oral history respondents. And there should be a lot more than what you see in his book of just repeated uses of phrases like might have been, could have been, possibly. In other words, the amount of conjecture and speculation in a book that is supposed to be the definitive product of such a monumental figure conducted by such a monumental scholar with such monumental backing, coming from such a monumentally large, dominant, globally reaching publisher, the standards should have been met. That is, that the sources should have been better vetted, the research more thoroughly conducted, more well cited, more accurately cited.
Right.
And given all that has been written about Malcolm X over the years since his assassination, there should have been no problem in Manning Marable conducting this more skillfully, as he had done in so much of his other research. So ultimately, that is why, you know, with great skill and nuance, we recognize that he put together something that ultimately is meant to liberalize Malcolm X and make him palatable for a post-Obama era, and ultimately somebody in support of democratic, bourgeois democratic politics and mainstream, political organization analysis. So,
what I want to do right there, Jared, is I want to hold that thought. What we're going to do is we're going to take a break. I know you have to make a run real quick, right. And we're going to come back, and I want to we want to get into the meat of your book, and talk about this trend that goes way beyond Malcolm X right now, but to actually erase and soften and I'll use the word sterilize militant radical of movements from the 60s. And put them in a certain type of nice box when in fact it was far from that. So let's talk about that when we come back.
Hi, Macy, you bet your life, baby. That's right, I'm down here with the world's most popular drinking areas, you understand?
People of the West are beginning to look homeward. They're beginning to look back toward the mother continent of Africa, and they're gaining spiritual strength from these roots. The African continent is on the rise. The motherland is on the rise, fighting and seeking and fighting for his place in the sun. But his fight is putting the same spirit in the black people in the West.
Responsibility.
We will not rest until that place has been secured.
Say it.
And we will not rest until that place has been secured.
We want an immediate end to the police brutality and mob attacks against the so-called Negroes throughout the United States.
Too much to do.
Brothers and sisters, friends, and I see some enemies.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, You represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not one.
We're back here. We had to play a little bit of Malcolm X, since we're talking about Malcolm X. And on the phone line, or actually with us via Skype in Washington, D.C., is Jared Ball. He's from our sister radio station, by the way, WPFW, among other things. And he also teaches at Morgan State. So he's a scholar and activist and somebody who does not play around when it comes to Malcolm X. Him and many others challenging the late, great Manny Marables, many of the points that were raised in his book. Before we went, you had laid out what it meant when you do, when you actually do a scholarly piece of work that is more than just somebody making an opinion and sharing their thoughts. This is rigorous work, and it took some time for you all to do the book. Now that we got that laid out, let's go over two or three of the main points that people had issues with that you all refute in this book.
Well, the largest point that I and my co-editor and others wanted to deal with were not some of the more salacious issues, as you mentioned already, about questions of infidelity or sexuality, although we do address those. We were looking more at the overall, the governing ideas of the book, the ideological and political positioning of the book, and the role that we saw it playing in the current political landscape, in this, again, post-racial, post-Obama, certainly post-civil and human rights struggle moment. So we addressed the concerns that we see coming from Marable and, of course, the elite publishing house, Viking Press, or subsidiary of Penguin, and, of course, Columbia University, where, again, as I said a moment ago, with great skill and nuance, and in a way that takes a close read and some a bit of understanding of the history of Malcolm X and the history of the literature about Malcolm X to catch. But what is done is that we saw that the book challenges most aggressively the radical ideas that Malcolm X represented and that he inspired in the rest of us, most notably revolutionary black nationalism. But of course, in the process of attacking that, Manny Marable goes after all forms of radical thought, the various strands of socialism and anti-imperialism, for instance. He attacks the Garvey movement and its position and its history, and in fact accuses Amy Jacques Garvey of murder, quite shockingly enough, with again out any substantive, without any substantiations, without any citations or real sourcing to back up that claim.
Well, let me try and simplify this just so it, put it in a little bit more layman's term. The narrative that we often hear with Malcolm X is that he was a guy that hated white people. He called them the devils. This is when he was a black Muslim, which we now know as the Nation of Islam. He leaves the Nation of Islam. He goes to Mecca. He comes back. He likes white people. And, and that's the narrative, right? And then to kind of contextualize it, when we look at it a little deeper, what it suggests is that Malcolm became more Americanized. Like, he wanted to follow more in the footsteps of Dr. King. He wanted to sit around and have these kumbaya moments. And, and if he was alive today, he would have been like right behind Barack Obama and endorsing everything. So there seems to be this shift that and tell me if I'm wrong, that people have had problems with, which suggests that Malcolm would no longer be fiercely critical of this country and many of the points that this country has now stood for, namely imperialism, large parts of capitalism, all these different types of things. And from what I'm gathering with Manny Marable's exhaustive work, quotations around the word exhaustive, he has moved Malcolm to that position. So you come away reading that Malcolm had not only had these flaws, but at the end of the day, he would have probably been sitting up there at the DNC in Charlotte, endorsing Barack Obama. And I guess your contention is like, no way, no how. Is that a decent summary?
That's exactly right. That what you get in Marable's book is something that does support. There's been this fight over Malcolm X since he was killed. That what did he mean? What did he want? Who gets to claim him? And everybody has laid claim to him. All the various forms of radical and progressive and even liberal thought has sought to claim Malcolm X as their own. And what we're arguing here is just that many Merrill tries to describe Malcolm's ideas as maturing in a quite linear fashion, in a straight line from, as you said, hating white people as devils in a very immature, unrational way or irrational way, which is itself a demonization of the Nation of Islam and a demonization of even that brand of black nationalism, which has its own depth and breadth and substantive basis that gets no play or no respect. And then sort of moves on to the point where after Mecca and seeing white-skinned individuals praying to Allah, that we're then to be told that Malcolm moved more to the political center, moved towards more the mainstream, and abandoned all the immature radicalism of the day and of his time, and moved towards something more pragmatic, more responsible, and as you said, more supportive of mainstream liberal politics, or in this case, Barack Obama's presidency. Where the evidence is just does not support that he maintained the most radical political positions, and what many of us argue is that he was becoming, the changes he was undergoing were making him more militant and more aggressively, as Dr. King said, divinely dissatisfied with the world as it was. So we wanted to replace that and be, as we tried to say, the negation of the negation. We wanted to block the attempt to block him out and to make him again palatable for today's moment without really looking critically at the point, as we try to argue, that today's worsening conditions, today's desperate need for political struggle would not exist in this form or fashion had Malcolm X and others not been assassinated, had not been imprisoned, and then subsequently had their images destroyed and their politics misappropriated and misdefined after their assassination to justify what is going on today as some sort of progress. And,
right.
So we are trying to deny Marable his attempt, as he tries to, particularly in the epilogue of his book, to put Malcolm X, quite as we've challenged other scholars like Peniel Joseph, as claiming that they've done the same thing, trying to put Malcolm X in this direct linear line preceding and laying the groundwork for Barack Obama and for, again, a mainstream liberal politics.
And
this is not what Malcolm X was about. And today, we desperately need as much now the kinds of radical analyses and political organization that Malcolm X was calling for, because all the conditions that he was trying to organize out of existence still exist, and in many ways are worse now than at the time he was still here.
Let me ask you this. We're talking about Malcolm X, but, and I said this before we went to the break, that there's been a trend in doing this all across. We most glaringly see that with Martin Luther King, where you literally have people who were directly opposed to him, like Ronald Reagan before he passed, were suddenly embracing him and holding up his ideals. We see the commercialization. We've seen even John McCain, who opposed his holiday, apologizing and say King was that guy. And then we see the likening of King to Barack Obama. Correct me if I'm wrong, the problems that people have had with that is that King was definitely anti-war to the point that he would give his life to maintain that position, and he literally did. The second thing is that we know that with King, we're led to believe that he was very popular by the time he died, but because he took those stances, many of the black churches that now like to claim him were actually actively opposed to him because he refused to accept the offerings of the Johnson administration and others. So that's just King. We've seen the sanitation or the demonization of the Black Panthers, most recently with the Richard Aoki allegations, where again the narrative is that the 60s movement was a good movement under King when he was having I Had a Dream, and somehow when the Panthers and everybody came along, it got ruined. So that seems to be, in academic circles, to be this pervasive thought that's out there, and it moves the words imperialism, it moves away militancy out the conversation, and and makes anybody who has that sort of viewpoint seem almost crazy. Like right now, you to a lot of people would be deemed crazy because outdated. That was back in the days. We're not there no more. Is that how does that measure up to what you were fighting with Malcolm, with this Malcolm book?
I mean, this is ultimately what we're arguing here, and why we put together so many people from sort of different experiences and backgrounds, so politically at least, or organizationally, to address these questions.
Who are some of the people that you have in the book?
Right, that's what I'm getting to. I mean, we have people that worked with and knew Malcolm X, like A. Peter Bailey and William Sayles. William Strickland. We have some of the leading scholars on Malcolm X and leading authorities on Malcolm X, like William Sayles, Zach Condo, Carl Evans, and others. We have other scholars of note in terms of black political history, black struggle, like Patricia Reed Merritt and Margot Arnold. We have people of my generation and your generation, members of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, Kali Okuno and Kamau Franklin. We have other scholars of this generation, brilliant thinkers like Greg Thomas and Chris Tinson, who have chimed in. So we have, again, we have this multi-generational, multi-experiential group of people who have all brought their focus to these questions and these issues. To make this point that Malcolm was an anti-imperialist black nationalist freedom fighter, as he said, up until his last days. He defended all forms of radical political organization, independent electoral political party building, underground guerrilla warfare and military training and preparation, internationalist anti-imperialist perspectives, an increasing willingness to work with radicals of all backgrounds in an international but very pan-African, non-aligned movement, people-led struggle. So these are the things, and he was, again, as I said a moment ago, trying to address things and conditions that have worsened. So as we ask in the book, in what world do we live in today where all of the issues that I've raised just now describing Malcolm X are no longer relevant? In what world do we live today where we don't need to have discussions about radical redistributions of wealth, radical responses to the worsening conditions of poverty and joblessness and increasing warfare and mass incarceration and police brutality? All of these things are increasingly worsening as we speak. So in what world do we live where the radical ideas that Malcolm X represented and that he inspired, that became, as our contributors know, the mainstream political ideology of the day? I mean, as you mentioned with the Black Panther Party, we have to remember that nearly every prominent radical group to come in the late 60s, early 70s, identified Malcolm X as a fountainhead of their work.
Right. Well, the Black Panthers considered themselves the sons of Malcolm.
Exactly. But so did, of course, so did the more cultural nationalist US organization. So did the Revolutionary Action Movement and the Republic of New Africa. So many organizations and so many efforts that arose sort of in the post-Malcolm moment had been working with Malcolm, had been inspired by Malcolm, and people like Robert Williams and others, all of whom are consigned to the far outposts of our historical knowledge, specifically so that we don't consider them for today and that we don't consider what their analysis would mean in 2012, which is ultimately why those of us gathered in our collective here came together, because we're saying that it's not just about Malcolm and his time, it's about us in our time, and we can't allow institutional state-sponsored imperialist-sponsored attacks on our leading figures and on our ideas that have inspired so many people and continue to inspire so many people and that deserve to be heard and dealt with and organized around right now.
Let me ask you this, Jared Ball, who is with us this afternoon, one of the authors of the book, A Lie of Reinvention, about Malcolm X. We do a lot of, you know, I'll use the word speculating just to make my point, because many of the people are dead. But one of the people that we've seen evolve or we've seen go down a particular path would be Nelson Mandela, head of the African National Congress. And one would look and say, well, here was a guy who was militant. Here's a guy that was take no punches type of cat. Here's a guy who gave, you know, 30 years of his life, you know, under torturous conditions. And then when you look at some of the positions he's taken or some of the positions he hasn't taken, one would say that he's moved to the center. And when you look at somebody like Mandela, one might be tempted to conclude that, well, maybe that is the natural progression that one would take, and that people who are claiming a certain type of radicalism, maybe they haven't matured enough. If you look at, if you juxtapose Nelson Mandela, who was, interestingly enough, juxtaposed in the Malcolm X movie by Spike Lee, how do you kind of reconcile that, looking at somebody who's still alive and, you know, you could say, man, he's, you know, he's moved to the center.
Well, a number of us, and not enough of us, have been arguing since he came on the political scene that Barack Obama represented dangerously for our nation and our moment what Nelson Mandela has unfortunately been forced to represent in terms of the South African and African liberation struggle, and that is compromise and the return to the same sort of state-sanctioned, state-sponsored corporate capitalism that allows for a handful of people to reap the reward and benefit of what all of us produce and consigns the rest of us to increasing poverty. So as we just look at what was happening with the miners' strike in South Africa today, it's a perfect example of where we're headed in this country, where it has already been reported that by, I think, 2042, we will become the official new apartheid state here in the United States. That is, where we will have a white minority that still has a majority of all the wealth and resources in a majority so-called people of color nation. And what we see it happen in South Africa since the release of Nelson Mandela and the end of official apartheid is that the conditions have remained and in fact worsened. Many people have argued, from people like John Pilger to Frank Wilderson to people in the street themselves, have argued that the conditions have worsened. I myself have been in the room and witnessed a black South African angry response to Desmond Tutu for himself denying the worsening conditions in post-apartheid South Africa and not doing enough to extend the benefits of the so-called improving world to a majority of the black Africans who remain there in poverty and again in worsening conditions. And what we see is just what has happened. I mean, in the same way that, as I was arguing, you have to kill Malcolm X to allow for a Barack Obama to flourish in a new political climate, the same thing had to happen in South Africa, where more militant and radical leaders had to be imprisoned or assassinated to allow for the post-apartheid flourishing of Nelson Mandela and an ANC under a soft, liberal, corporate, capitalist, emerging society. So would you have, Chris Hani had to be assassinated so that Nelson Mandela could thrive. And by the way, and Frank Wilderson reminds us of this fact that it was Chris Hani who was more popular than Mandela among the black African community in South Africa.
Right.
He was more willing to remain committed to the socialist revolution, to a militant defense of that revolution. And he had to be assassinated so that the more white-friendly and business-friendly Mandela could be allowed to thrive. Now, so this is not just a matter of wanting to pick on individuals to be critical of, certainly not, legends like Mandela, having to withstand criticisms from the lowly likes of people like me. The question is, what is the political and ideological trajectory of this moment, and who is guiding it, and under what, and who is leading the interpretation of the past as we develop ideas and strategies to build in the present?
Right.
And this is ultimately what I think all of us have come together to do in our book, criticizing and again reminding as best we can that the reinvention that has been imposed on Malcolm X by Viking Press and Manny Marable is a lie.
Let me, because we're running out of time, I want to go through just a quick list and you can give us some short answers and what you're finding. Right now, with the election around the corner, many people are pointing to Malcolm X's speech, The Ballad of the Bullet, and saying that Malcolm would have been out there leading voter registration drives and would have had people voting. What are you all finding with respect to that?
Well, this is actually a point that I mentioned specifically in the introduction of our book, that what Manny Marable does in recounting that particular speech and Malcolm's organizational plan around voting is to truncate and cut off the actual comment so that it reads very differently. In other words, the true statement that Malcolm was making about the Organization of Afro-American Unity's desire for developing electoral voting bases was that black people would be organized, as he said, into independent voting blocks who would support only candidates who supported black people. So this is very different than the way Marable quotes it and the way we're encouraged by more liberal defenders of the current moment, where they cut off those statements to just say we want to develop black people into voting blocks and have everybody registered to vote. That was not Malcolm's point. And ultimately, put in complete context of the entire speech, Malcolm is arguing that the vote cannot be all that we focus on, cannot be all that we organize around, and will not likely in and of itself lead us to any change given the nature of the political system in this country. So again, what he was arguing we do about the vote is much more akin, I would argue, to what Du Bois was saying at the end of his life, where in 1956, he argued that we organize ourselves into non-voting blocks to demonstrate our refusal to participate in an unjust electoral political system.
Right.
We would stop voting for the lessers of evil, where we would acknowledge, as Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report, it says that Obama is the more effective evil as opposed to the lesser of, and that our efforts to organize ourselves for electoral politics or otherwise would be to in ways that would legitimately grant us power and the ability to impact change, not just to sort of sheepishly follow behind, again, the most, you know, heavily Wall Street funded corporate backed candidates that may have blacker faces than someone else or may have a Democratic Party claiming that they're more liberal than the other.
Right.
Again, this is just not what Malcolm was arguing for, and we need to be very clear about that, whatever our decisions are about what we're going to do in 2012.
Right, and also Malcolm was very critical of both the Democrats and the Republicans, which people forget.
The whole fox and the sheep analogy, that the brilliant use of that play on words was specific to this issue of the lesser of two evil syndrome, and why he was ultimately advocating that we avoid that by organizing ourselves only to vote for people who would defend us, which ultimately I think was his point to make, that if we organize ourselves in that way, we will be able to organize ourselves in many other ways, and more important ways, to more fundamentally address the situation here.
Malcolm's evolution around race. How does this play out in your book? Where does he go with this?
Well, I mean, again, Manny Marable describes Malcolm X as a race, at the end of his life, as embracing a race-neutral third world or pan-African outlook, which itself is a contradiction. When Malcolm was simply grappling with the reality that, yes, you can find people with various skin tones who have various worldviews, but at the end of the day, there is a white supremacist, imperialist, Zionist capitalism that has to be addressed. And regardless of what people, what language people use to describe themselves, those are ultimately the things that have to be confronted and confronted on any number of different levels. So again, Malcolm X at the end of his life was still referring to himself as a black nationalist freedom fighter, as someone linking up with the pan-African, pan-non-aligned, pan-people of color world to address a Western dominant, European, Eurocentric, imperialist trajectory and tendency in the world. So this idea that he came back from Mecca and embraced a liberal integrationism is pure mythology. And all that people have to do, yes, we want everybody to read our book, and we encourage people to read Marable's book and all the other books written on Malcolm X. But all really people have to do is consult the primary source text, and that is Malcolm himself. And then most of this controversy more or less fades away. It's the window dressing that has been put up around him, we think intentionally to confuse readers and listeners of Malcolm X, that has caused and continues to attempt to cause these kinds of controversies.
Militancy, and I'm using this word in respect to the hip-hop generation, which we're a part of. There was a point in time in the late 80s, early 90s, where Malcolm was sampled in over hundreds of rap songs. He was sampled so much that he was featured on the cover of the popular magazine at the time, The Source Magazine, and considered like the best MC of his day. With that being said, you know, and understanding how Malcolm was an inspiration for this younger generation, has our generation misinterpreted Malcolm differently than the way that Manny Marable has? And by that, when I say militancy, many people have looked at Malcolm and said, well, you know, I got to get this gun. We're going to go and really start, you know, tearing stuff up. You know, you hear that from people in certain types of corners who are anti-capitalists, for example. You hear others that would say that Malcolm would have been with the Panthers and would have been much more confrontational towards the police. That would be another type of scenario. You also hear that when the age of crack and drugs and that sort of proliferation in our community, that Malcolm would have been leading, you know, vile young men and women to beat back, you know, those forces in our own communities that, of course, havoc. So from your work, what are you seeing, you know, Malcolm's take on these things?
Well, as our contributors in various ways point out, it's impossible, we argue, to look at the evidence, look at the primary source text, that is Malcolm's speech, his writings, and conclude that he would have been anywhere to the right of where he was at the end of his life, or that he would have been sort of accepting any of the mainstream responses to what's going on now. In fact, as our contributors point out, somewhat along the lines of what you were saying, that these sort of institutional responses to Malcolm X, or to us and our love of Malcolm X, come at times where there are moments of resurgence of the icon, of the symbol, and of course, more importantly, the ideas, so that in the late 80s, early 90s, there had to be the Bruce Perry book to come out to sort of attempt to be an institutional state-sponsored response to the groundswell of love and support for Malcolm X as new generations were coming to grips with who Malcolm was. You know, so that people like me, I mean, and many of us who are perfect examples of this, who are introduced to Malcolm X through rap music, and somewhat of a popular cultural phenomenon, wouldn't then begin to read Malcolm and listen to Malcolm, and then worse, accept those ideas and organize around them. That was the point. And we're arguing that this book comes at a time where, again, there is an international groundswell for radical politics and radical organization, because the conditions continue to worsen. As this country deals with whether it's the Occupy or the response to stop and frisk or many of the other things that we continue to have to struggle with, people are new coming to Malcolm X, and that the state and the institution, the dominant institutions, can't allow that happen without some sort of mediation, without some sort of interrupted moment where we are told that Malcolm was making up, you know, how much of a thug he was, or how much of a dope dealer he was, or Malcolm was engaged in homosexual activity, or infidelity, or, you know, really wasn't that militant at the end of his life. You know, these are the things that we would be encouraged to focus on, debate, as opposed to really getting to the nuts and bolts of what Malcolm X represented, and ultimately why he was assassinated, not the least of which, by whom, and for what purposes, you know. All of these things are meant to be obscured. So again, at the end of the day, those in power can maintain their power. And again, as I keep trying to say, maintain the worsening conditions and the worsening inequalities that we see now and that we're going to see in the near future.
Right. Well, that about wraps it up. Show everybody the book, Jared Ball, so we can make sure to get a copy of it. There it is, A Life of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. Jared Ball, we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We're out for now, folks. Peace.
Down, the story's all about street life. with most stiff by the gun and others live by the knife. This ain't no pop record or another fake hit. Cause when we come here, though, we come legit. Now the real dumb people won't understand this. And the power's gonna clench their fists, yeah. But we could care less cause we tell it how it is. Now let me get down to biz. When we was growing up, we was living in poverty. Hand-me-down clothes was given to me. Poor memories, boy, I got them. Holy broke dead socks coming out the bottom. And the apartment was roach infested. One double bed is where four of us rested. We didn't have Jack, we double O-R. Now I'm a well-paid star. But back then, my parents never had enough dough. I had to rob a chump for a pair of shell toes. They had the rent to pay, plus they had bills. So a brother had to get ill and go for mine, the only way I knew how. Whatever, whatever, I'm trying to tell you now, kid. It was robbing or stealing or selling drugs on the street. Cause a brother gotta eat, yeah. But then I got older and bolder. Turned into a crazy hard soldier. Now I'm the Mac Top General. Moving keys for these cause I'm the Grand Imperial. And the streets we're controlling. And the Kanawha Bay cop is on the payroll. And my brother, your majesty, been with me. We've been scared from day O-N-E. We're playing the crazy ill game with survival. The thought of us starving to death on arrival. We're untouchable, goddamn immortal. After the hook, magic kick tomorrow.
Raised in the ghetto, singing songs for survival.
To make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. There's a difference. When you study the historic nature of revolutions, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words, you may devise another program, you may change your goal, and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. Number one, it was based on land, the basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution, what was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost, was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. If you're afraid to bleed, as long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn-the-other-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a non-violent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's non-violent is the Negro Revolution. Based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution.
desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilets. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way.